Shouldn't surprise us that God spends time listing in his top 10 the topic that is on people's minds as much as anything else. I've never figured out exactly how they do it, but I've read the studies, as I'm sure you have, that what people think about all day, and like 80% of the time, is sex and death. God would be sleeping on the job if he didn't have something to say about something that cuts to the very core of who we are and our identity. And I'll illustrate it with a story, a true story, about a seaman in World War II. He was on this aircraft carrier in a battle in the Coral Sea, and a strafing shell, a 20-millimeter shell from a Japanese plane, went through his chest and his stomach and lodged in his hip without exploding. Nobody knew what to do with this guy. He was a walking bomb. As a matter of fact, they put a little tag around his wrist that said, warning, live bomb, unexploded bomb. And they took real care not to jostle him or bump him or anything like that, and they finally strapped him on a cot, and they strung a cable over to a nearby hospital ship, and they transported him over to that ship, and 2 weeks later, they finally removed the shell. They fired it through a little tissue paper, and the moment it hit the tissue paper, it exploded. This man was literally a walking bomb. I sometimes think, when it comes to this maddening sexual drive that God has put in each of us, that we sometimes feel like we're walking around like a live bomb. We don't know just when it'll go off, what'll jostle us, or the sunspots will change, and we'll find ourselves in trouble, and we can injure people around us. And if not that, then maybe you have been around somebody who detonated, as it were, and you were one of those victims who was injured. That's why God gives us this seventh secret. All of these secrets we have seen are designed to put certain protective fences around us to help us discover the deepest secrets and exceptional experiences of life. And this is no different than any of those things. The commandment is not to commit adultery, but the implication is that the sexual relationship between a man and a woman, opposite genders, is for marriage. It's not just speaking of violating a marriage, but not violating that which belongs in marriage from the outside. Married or unmarried, sex is for marriage. That's the theme of that whole thing. And you don't need me to tell you that today, that is extremely unpopular. There may be people today who think somebody actually believes that anymore. And B, as if being unpopular wasn't hard enough, it's just downright difficult to try to live that way. There are temptations. This sexualized society has a whole smorgasbord of options out there for every conceivable taste. In fact, some inconceivable taste. And they just beckon. And they say, this is excitement. This is stimulation. This is the way to go. And it's precisely because this whole thing is so powerful that God has said, put a protective fence around it. Those things which have the greatest potential for helping that we take care of. We have to be careful how we drive. The car is a powerful machine. You take care of children because they're a little more vulnerable. When you have movers pack a vase, you want to be sure they put a lot of protective padding around it because it's particularly valuable to you and you want to be sure that it is preserved. And so God does the same thing with relationships because they're vulnerable. And the very power that can make marriage so sensational is a power which run amok can cause all kinds of destructive damage. When it works the way it's supposed to, something emerges in marriage that is as beautiful as it is rare. Sam Levinson said, love at first sight's easy to understand, but when two people can look at each other for years, it becomes a miracle. I want to talk about how to develop that kind of miracle in our lives, how to develop love for the long haul. It's going to take something called commitment. That is the fence that protects God's gift of sexuality. And I want to explore with you today why that fence needs to be there. We're not getting a lot of propaganda in this direction. It's all in the other way, and a lot of it's lies. Let's see if we can make some kind of sense out of why God would put such a maddening barrier in front of us and these powerful drives. Number one, because of the joy of love. Commitment enhances the joy. It makes the joy overflow. There are two mistakes that we can make in the whole area of understanding sex. One would be to despise it. And one of the tragedies that I think actually fueled the sexual revolution in the past generation were negative attitudes that crept into the Christian community about sex. Somebody somewhere got Victorian hypocrisy confused with Christian piety. But the Bible isn't squeamish at all. If you just start at the beginning and read through the Bible, right around the middle, you'd run into a bizarre little book called the Song of Solomon. Nothing would prepare you for what's in that book. There's nothing that's not tasteful, But you've been asleep for years. You can't figure out what it is that book's talking about. It's a remarkably graphic and lyrical. It's a book of love, poetry. Book of Proverbs has that sort of thing. But most importantly, if we really believe God created us, He's the one that put the wiring in there. It means all the playfulness, all the creativity, all the dynamic involved in this aspect of our lives is something that God put in there and that He wants us to experience and to enjoy. And the fact is, you are not just a human being. You are a male human being, or you are a female human being. And I can't believe we have to spell this out to people in the 1990s, but you do. Everything you do and think and say is affected by your chromosomes on this deal. The way you deal socially, the kids, the people that you played with when you were a kid, the way you relate to people in the world today, the way you feel physiologically, the way you think psychologically, just the way you look at the world and interpret your environment, God has shaped all of that in there. And He has put that wonderful femininity or masculinity in it, in you, that beckons to other people. And that attraction that you feel, God put there. Let me make it more blunt. He wants you to feel attracted to the opposite gender. And not only that, where we believe that the Bible actually says that sex is for pleasure and not just procreation. Because there are people who will argue that, no, it's just to produce children and the pleasure is incidental. And I think it's exactly the other way around. It's for pleasure and the children, maybe incidental is too light a word, but they're the byproduct of this joyful union and excitement that two people share together. And we ought to be grateful for that gift from God. The pleasure produces a powerful oneness. The Bible calls it one flesh. And it would say, it uses the language in terms of sexual interplay of knowing somebody. There's a knowledge that transpires between two people. And so that powerful one flesh experience is a heightening of that sense of belonging to one another. It's God's vehicle for saying, I am totally, completely committed to you. And the whole drama speaks in physical terms of something that's going on deep, deep down inside. So, if it is wrong to deify sex, it is wrong to despise it. Both are equally wrong. Let me look at the opposite text, because we're in a culture that, by and large, deifies it. There is a transcendent power in this whole thing. There's almost a standing outside of oneself in amazement and feeling a sense of awe and mystery that is associated with the mystique femininity and masculinity when they relate to each other in this way. And it has an almost religious intensity to it, and it seems to promise something transcendental. And so some people exalt that into a god. And as you look at idolatry in the Old Testament, it was often accompanied by temple prostitution. Various sexual acts were performed to make it rain and cause the crops to grow and everything else. That's how it was always intertwined in false religion. And to this day, I would say there's a strong element of that as well. Now, the actual pleasure involved in sex is a sign pointing to a deeper joy of relationship. What's going on the physical level has to take place on the emotional and psychological levels. There has to be a union between two people, a giving of one another to each other. And if you take the physical component and then divorce it and rip it apart from the other parts of who we are as human beings and play with it recreationally, but not using it relationally, then it becomes a hideous monster. It becomes a complete contradiction in terms. To engage in sexual relationships apart from commitment is an act of deceit. It's an act of treachery. It's body language which says, I belong to you and I'm committed to you, when in fact we don't mean anything of the sort. And there are people in here that could all say, I know exactly what you mean, and I learned it the hard way. I thought the person meant, this means we belong to each other. Even the most free thinkers, Bertrand Russell, to mention one, who promoted free love and said we shouldn't have any boundaries in our sexual relationships, but he didn't want anybody messing around with his wife. You'll find that kind of hypocrisy and double standard all over the place. So, the issue is not pleasure. There's nothing wrong with pleasure. Let me say it more emphatically. It is good. God gave it, and it's wrong for us to despise it. Even though, as I speak, I feel keenly aware that somebody, I don't know who you are, but some of you have been deeply wounded and hurt by somebody who abused this gift, and the last thing that comes to your mind is pleasure. But understand that while you may be wounded and scarred, God's intent for that was a good intent. So commitment enhances the joy. The joy is in the relationship, and commitment makes the relationship work, which leads us to the second reality that we need to understand, is that commitment provides for intimacy. It allows us to go down deep in our relationships rather than stay on a surface level. A lot of times people get into marriage like a contract. Some of them will write out ahead of time, when this thing spins apart, never mind all those mushy things I said last night, but when this thing spins apart, this is yours, this is mine. We come into it as a tentative bargaining deal. That is a long ways from the sort of total entrusting of yourself to another person that God envisions when he speaks about one flesh. The fact is, when you seal a deal with somebody, you shake hands. This is shaking hands and then some. This moves shaking hands to a whole new level. But if you make a deal and shake hands and you understand you're sealing some kind of commitment there and the person bilks you, you feel wrong. And in the same way, when you engage in this sort of physical level of relationship with somebody and the commitment isn't there, you feel deeply, deeply wounded. The fact is that sex is extremely risky, and the physical nakedness that accompanies it is accompanied by an emotional nakedness as well. There's a vulnerability, and we make ourselves vulnerable to another person. We discover something of our identity, and we almost give a little bit of ourselves away, and that whole fantastic drama seems to speak of that. Two people are meshed together. As I give part of myself away, and there's a commitment there, it comes back to me. But if the commitment isn't there, part of me is given away almost as though it never comes back again. And deep, deep down in the subconscious, you realize that. Deep, deep down in the subconscious, if you can't really trust that person, if you can't really be emotionally naked with that person, and you can't give yourself to the person, and part of you, whether conscious or otherwise, holds back. And so you're parked in sort of a safe orbit where you sort of get some kind of fake pseudo-intimacy and you go through the motions, but the real fire and the real spark and the real abandonment is not there. What a tragedy. And then you know what happened? Then this thing which held out so much promise, that passion, and all those fireworks and everything that you dreamed about, it begins to diminish it. And even, can this be, in the 1990s, even sex itself begins to diminish in enthusiasm and excitement. And your eye and your heart begin to wander around and say, well, the kick's gone, the fizz is out of that bottle. Let's look for somebody else out there. Maybe that person can spark me up and excite me and get me jump-started again. And it's great for a while at that initial adventure, but of course you went into this one with even less commitment because you've already been disillusioned. And so this one fades and the fizz disappears even more quickly. And you find yourself getting less and less of a kick. Now, if you're addicted to the kick, you can get into some very deviant, bizarre kinds of things, which we won't explore today. But can you see that downward spiral, and can you see that it's not going where you want to go? And meanwhile, you have two people over here that are deeply committed to each other, and they have freedom. I found secondary references, but I couldn't find the primary reference. But I've seen reports, maybe you have, that did studies on the sex lives of religious people and non-religious people. And you know what they found out? Are you ready for this? You got your seatbelts on? These people over here were far more sexually fulfilled because they tended to make deeper commitments. Commitment enhances the intimacy, and we've already seen that the intimacy creates the joy. And that's the fallacy in living together. Let's not talk just in condemnation, let's just talk in the logic that it doesn't work. What are we living together for? Well, we're going to experiment and see if we're compatible. But the thing we're going to leave out is the commitment. But the commitment's the thing that makes it work. So it's a flawed experiment that leaves out the most crucial ingredient, because here's what happens. If you last more than a few months, if you last a few years, you begin to change. And were you prepared for this? Of course the person changed. You married them, didn't you? So they change and they evolve or mutate, depending upon your personal perspective. And the only thing that can keep that thing going, keep the wheels on the wagon, is the commitment to adapt and to change and to recognize the unity there, and that you don't want to tear the fabric of your soul by breaking apart. I quote no less an authority, and I don't know if I'll ever quote her on anything else, Dr. Ruth. She's not even a doctor, and I have real mixed feelings about Dr. Ruth, but even she said that living together doesn't work. So if you want to take a lower authority on the totem pole than the Bible, you can take Dr. Ruth. What happens so often is two people come together and pretend like they're relating intimately, but they've left out the real thing because it's too risky. And they're parked in an orbit where they can't be totally alone, but they never experience what it's really all about. Commitment enhances the joy of love and it provides for the intimacy of love, but it also ensures the freedom of love. And you can see how that flows from this. There's a false premise you see under the contemporary sexual morality that says people are basically good and won't hurt you. That somehow you can gauge in this and somebody can take this most powerful nuclear force burning inside of us and won't abuse you or hurt you with it. And it would seem to me that the most elementary acquaintance with the newspaper or world history would make you realize, empirically verifying, that people do not treat each other that kind of a way at all. A study at the University of South Dakota that I came across recently did a random sampling of 408 women, and it says that almost 21% had been victims of date rape. 21%. Is that the kind of world that you want to live in? True freedom is freedom from negative forces that destroy life. Last week we said the sixth secret was to affirm life on every level. God is life. God wants his life to be pulsing through your veins. He wants you alive, not a zombie parked in front of a TV trying to get stimulated. He wants you to be alive. Well, putting this fence around our sexual lives protects us and gives us freedom. For example, freedom from loneliness and abandonment, where there's real commitment. It gives us freedom from fear, blackmail, extortion, being found out by my spouse or my children, or for generations down the road, oh yeah, that was great-granddad who really made a bad choice back at this point in his life. Freedom from exploitation. Freedom from the loss of self-respect and self-esteem. When you make yourself emotionally naked and vulnerable before another person, and they betray you, what you feel is personally violated. People are surprised sometimes when somebody goes into their house and robs things, and they come home and they find the drawers out and ransacked and some of the stereos and the silverware taken, and they feel deeply, deeply wounded by that, and they'll say, I feel personally violated and dirty somehow. And I'm telling you, that's one megaton on a 10-megaton scale to what happens when somebody betrays you on this level where we thought we were making a deep, deep commitment to one another. Elizabeth Elliot says, I don't want to be among the marked down goods on the bargain table. Cheap because they've been pawed over. Crowds collect there. It's only the few who'll pay the full price. Those are stiff words. But she's saying, I want to put a higher value on myself than to be just a welcome mat for anybody that happens to come along. How about freedom from disease? I discovered this week that over 1 million people in the 90s in America alone are going to die of AIDS. But even if you have something lesser than that, and by the way, not all of them will have violated this fence. Some of them just went into the hospital and got an innocent blood transfusion, or they were children born to people. What does that say about our idea that what two consenting adults do in the privacy of their room just don't affect the rest of us? Give me a break. That is what I would call not true. What about freedom from deadness and boredom? There's something about divorcing our sexuality from the other dimensions of a relationship begins to lose its excitement. The reason it exists is cut off from it. It's a flower plucked out by the roots, and now the petals start to wither. And a certain boredom begins to settle into our lives. And what's interesting is that you begin to lose touch with all kinds of things in life. Do you remember the first time you fell in love or even just got infatuated? That sort of emotional carbonation. And everything you looked at looked fantastic. You were in love. It just didn't matter that the world is on the brink of disaster. I mean, you were transcendent. It was fantastic. And take that and make a reverse negative image of it. And when you become dead in this area of your lives, you're dead indeed. You're dead to the things that are going on around you. Primarily what we're driving at is the freedom, not only from those negative life-destructing influences, but freedom for entering into something precious and valuable. The irony is that freedom is a result of constraint. Let me quote. I've quoted him before, Igor Stravinsky. You all remember Igor Stravinsky. I'm quoting him actually as an authority on music, not the other topic, but it applies. Listen. My freedom will be so much the greater and more meaningful the more narrowly I limit my field of action and the more I surround myself with obstacles. Whatever diminishes constraint diminishes strength. The more constraints one imposes, the more one frees oneself of the chains that shackle the spirit. I know an historian who actually argues that where cultures have had sexual standards that they adhered to, that there was energy to build a nation, kind of like America in the first 200 years or maybe 180 or whatever it was. And where cultures lose their control in this area, it spills over into every area of their life, and they lose the will to really survive, to value their families, to provide for the next generation. Isn't that interesting? I read a book this week by an Austin doctor, Dr. Glenn Wood. He tells a story about a gal named Lisa who was sexually abused by her stepfather as a child. So when she became age 16, she moved out as fast as she could. Moved in with her boyfriend. Of course, that didn't work real well, so she got out of that. She was one of these girls who had been trained, conditioned, brainwashed, if you will, to dress provocatively, speak in a high, squeaky voice, be extremely childlike and dependent. That's what she thought men wanted. She had no self-esteem, self-identity whatsoever. If a guy said, "Would you go out with me?" she just would go, "Yes." If the guy wanted her to go to bed with him that night, sure, whatever. And the doctor began to counsel with her. And as they talked, he said, "What is it that you want?" And she said something very interesting. She pointed, her eyes just fixed on something over his head, and she says, "I want that." And he turned around and looked up behind his head, and there was a picture of his family, smiling, loving, arms around each other, looking into the camera. And he began to help her grasp what it means to be a child of God, someone who is deeply valued, who is not abused by God, who is precious, infinitely precious, so much that God would give his own son and validate her value. And he said it was very interesting. Her whole attitude began to change. She learned a little two-letter, one-syllable word to use with the male gender, no. She began to dress differently. Nobody told her to do it. Nobody set any rules down. She just could put two and two together and figure out, well, if I don't want to relate to men in that way, I dress in this way. And most interesting to me, at least, was her voice dropped into a lower female register. She didn't become a bass singer, but she became a woman instead of a child. It was a beautiful story that I read. Now, that's why God puts that fence around there to protect us. That's what morality is about. Morality doesn't ask the question, what feels good? Morality asks the question, says, what is right? And they're not exactly the same thing. I found a quote from C.S. Lewis. We all need a weekly transfusion of C.S. Lewis. Here's it this week. When I was a youngster, all the progressive people were saying, why all this prudery? Let us treat sex just as we treat all our other impulses. I was simple-minded enough to believe they meant what they said. But I've since discovered that they meant exactly the opposite. They meant that sex was to be treated as no other impulse in our nature has ever been treated by civilized people. All the others, we admit, have to be bridled, but every kindness and breach of faith seems to be condoned, provided that the object aimed at is four bare legs and a bed. Could you follow? He's facile, isn't he? Let me give you the Frank Boswell version, if I can follow him. What he said was, we start out saying, oh, this is just like all our other impulses. But in fact, we recognize we have to contain impulses everywhere. And what we really do is just unleash this monster and let it run around, and then we wonder, why do people get damaged? And the punchline, it's a morality in which stealing fruit is wrong unless you steal nectarines. What we need to do is go back to the owner's manual. We need to do more than just say no. We need to just say yes to freedom, to dignity, to self-respect, to health, to love, to mutual encouragement in the things that make life beautiful. Commitment enhances joy, provides intimacy, ensures freedom, and lastly, promotes rebuilding. The fact is that not one of us can be everything that we ought to be in this area. You think I'm talking to people that had affairs? Did you see what Jesus said? You've heard it said, don't commit adultery. Yes, I've heard that. But I'm telling you that if a man just looks at a woman lustfully, he's already committed adultery with her in his heart. Every guy in this room just went, or he lied. But don't think that it's just men. Jesus was picking on men because in that male-dominated society, they had a way of sort of tailoring the morality to protect themselves. And they actually taught, oh, don't worry about your thoughts, as long as you don't actually intend to go do something with it. Does this sound familiar? That was a very religious culture. We're in a very secular culture. Hear the same thing. I can watch anything. We can film anything. We can rate it any way we want. Doesn't matter. It won't affect me. Well, either take their word for it or take Jesus. Who do you respect? Who do you believe? And if this is what he means by adultery, then who is not guilty at some point of having failed in this area? None of us can keep the standard. That's just basic in principle in Christianity. You understand what adultery means? It means to adulterate something. You know what adulterate means? You ever buy something and it says pure, unadulterated? It means no contaminant, the way nature intended, or God in this case. So rather than adulterate our sexuality, to adulterate or dilute or pollute this dimension of our lives, by keep it pure, he means clean, wholesome, strong, refreshing, invigorating, everything that I thought we all kind of wanted. The irony is that when you see somebody cross this boundary, and I'm in a position where I'm privy to those lives of people, but so are you, have you not seen the tremendous damage that it has done? Haven't you seen not just two consenting adults, but spouses, children, parents, friends, work associates, depending on how public something is, it can just be terrible. But I have also seen a rebuilding take place in lives that is absolutely incredible. Something of beauty begins to emerge in those two lives, and I'll tell you why. Because they took a look at each other and said, instead of junking this thing, we're going to build. They began to exercise commitment. Maybe it was the first time they really made that kind of commitment. Not necessarily, but in some cases. You wonder, if they had taken that commitment and put it back before that destructive choices were made, would they not have produced something even more beautiful? The same vase, but without the cracks and the scars. You have to glue the vase back together here, and God can make something beautiful out of it. But you ask those people, and they say, I wish we'd built a vase without cracks. I'm thoroughly happy. I love my husband. I love my wife. I'm fulfilled. I have no regrets about my life today. But do I have regrets about what happened? I'm glad. I rejoice that God brought something beautiful out of it, but I wish we'd never dropped the vase to begin with. And so commitment means building a wall of protection. And if what Jesus says here is true, it means that we need to start with the mind, because the mind is the primary sex organ in the body. If it ain't working up here, it ain't working anywhere else. It starts in here. And where we get into trouble is up here. Mike Iaconelli tells a story about growing up in ranching country. And he says, believe it or not, cows can actually get lost from time to time. If you ask a rancher, how does a cow get lost? I thought they moved in committees. He'll tell you, well, one of them will spot a tuft of grass and he'll mosey over there and bend down and nibble at that tuft of grass. And then he'll look over and he'll see another little green tuft of grass and he'll go over there and he'll nibble that one for a while. And then he'll see another one over there and he'll notice a hole in the fence and there's a tuft of grass on the other side of that fence. And he'll go over and nibble that tuft and pretty soon he's over the horizon and gone. And he doesn't know where he is. And some of us are just, we've left the committee meeting because we found this little piece of grass to nibble on. It's perfectly innocent. I was made for grass. So we eat the grass, and then there's another one. And then somewhere, somehow, we're right next to the fence. It's just a couple feet away. There's a big hole in the fence. And I feel like eating that tuft of grass. And we nibble our way across the boundaries, and pretty soon we nibble ourselves into real trouble. You understand that being made the way you are, you can simply be in the room with certain types of people, and the circuit board lights up. It isn't just men. And it's just chemistry. What I'm saying to you is you need to be honest with yourself about this. You need to be honest about this. Some people around that turn the old crank, that get you charged up. And you don't even need to feel guilty about that. That is not a sin. That's just part of being a human being in this kind of a world. Where you get into trouble is when you start getting out the projector and showing slides. It's when you go through the mental seductions and fantasies that you get into trouble. Then you begin dwelling on it. I'd say that adultery out here begins when sex gets adulterated down in here. So putting a fence means starting here. It means starting to manage my life so I don't go out to lunch with people or get caught in positions by myself or collecting seashells late at night with somebody who's not my spouse. Whatever it may be, I start to get a little bit savvy about this. And I start to realize that I want a fence around this. Not because it doesn't attract. The whole problem is it does attract, but because this is important to me and I have a commitment to that. It means I'm going to watch out what kind of film comes into my mind through the eyes, whether it's some sort of stimulating movie or whether it's a book that just gets me thinking along channels I don't need to be in. But more importantly, I need to make my spouse a priority. My spouse has needs also, and I need to be, part of my commitment is wanting to meet those needs of my spouse. Somewhere in here, and I guess this is as good a place as any, I need to say this, because we're in a culture that says, you know, if you don't engage in this kind of behavior, you're going to die or break out warts. I don't know which is worse. And it's just not true. There's not one shred of evidence for that, if you care at all about scientific evidence. Paul didn't die from not being married. C.S. Lewis spent most of his life not being married. Mother Teresa's never been married. Did those people look like they didn't have robust, full lives? How about Jesus? Jesus was not androgynous. Maybe Michael Jackson is, but Jesus wasn't. It meant that he felt like a man. He knew what attraction was. He would have had the longings to marry and have children and engage in passionate encounters. That's what it meant that he was human. But it doesn't mean that he crossed those fences that we've been talking about this morning. So if you're not married, please don't feel like you're less than human. We need a sense of proportion about it. And then let me say this. Many, maybe most of us, have failed somewhere, somehow in our lives in this area. And I want to end on the positive note. Don't let that failure defeat you. This is not an unforgivable sin. The very same Jesus, he says, if you just look lustfully, then you have adulterated sexuality and marriage, is the same Jesus to whom the Pharisees brought a woman caught in the very act of adultery. I'll let your mind figure out what that's all about. And they throw this woman down humiliatingly, covered with a hastily gathered robe, and they say she was caught in the very act of adultery. And I read my rule book, Jesus, it says you should be stoned. What do you say? Cameras are running, microphones are live. Jesus doesn't answer the question. He bends down, starts to draw in the dust. Scholars have debated for years, what was he writing? What was he doing? And so they thought, oh good, we've got a wounded prey, and they moved in for the kill. Come on, what do you say? What do you say? Don't you think she should be stoned? Do you not believe in the law of God? What's the deal? And so he stands up, he says, I believe that the stone needs to be thrown by the person here without sin. Do we have any volunteers? Nobody ever thought of it quite like that before. And since they all knew each other in their secrets, kind of like a fraternity, you know, nobody actually wanted to step out and say, well, sure, I could throw that stone. If it had been me, I would have said, yeah, let's get the guy that was caught in the act with her. She didn't do this by herself, and let's do both of them. But Jesus, the very one who condemns the adultery, says, who has without sin? Let him throw the stone. Jesus is the only one in that crowd without sin, and he refuses to throw a stone. And when everybody slinks away back into their scummy little caves, Jesus says, where are your accusers? And she looks at him. I'm sure she was trying to compute this and thinks, they're gone. And he says, I don't condemn you either. Go. A new life. Back to your husband. Rebuild it. Put it back together. He says, go and sin no more. That's the difference. He says, don't do this because it'll hurt you and it'll destroy you. Here's what I want to say to you. Remember the old expression, going all the way? Go all the way. I mean, all the way. Go for total commitment. Go for a relationship with whole org, because there are riches in that that you can't have any other way. You're getting old, ladies and gentlemen. I don't care how much oil of Olay, I don't care if you sleep in this stuff. You're getting old. What would it be like to come to the end of your life with somebody, and you have your own little mansion of shared memories and closets and secret rooms, and you look at each other and you rock on that chair trying to catch enough oxygen. And you look at each other and you just kind of wink and you twinkle and you say, yeah, I knew you in your full strength, and I know what kind of tiger lurks under that serene, wrinkled surface. I know who you are, and you know who I am, and we have those shared memories and secrets that can't be had in any other way. You have failures in the past. Some of you may have to come to grips with that, but what God wants you to do is be faithful where you are today and be faithful to that relationship that God has given you. The day will come, whether now or later, the relationship comes to an end, if only because you die, but how much better it is to die without regret. How much better, even if you're separated from that person whom you've known a lifetime, to have a sorrow which is sweetened with the memories and the cleanness and the strength. And as a Christian, to know that we're headed for a world where we're going to live. And all of these joys are pointers to something so much more fantastic that everything here is just milquetoast. People, why not the best? Go all the way. Love for the long haul. Let's pray. Father, thank you for the gift of our sexuality, our femininity, our masculinity. Thank you for the precious partners that you have given us. And Lord, thank you that you accept and love us despite our failures, but help us to go and to sin no more, to find strength and fresh resolve to commit ourselves, not to be afraid of it, but to take the radical plunge of commitment and to engage one another's lives in the deepest possible level. Help us to discover that secret of exceptional living. And we pray it in Jesus' name.